Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is pleased to welcome students from Pflugerville High School to the session this afternoon. This afternoon we have two clauses to be presented on oral argument. In the order in which we will hear them, they are as follows. First National Bank of Hot Springs and Others versus Texas Sun Beechcraft North Incorporated and Others from Dallas County, and F. Michael Schultz versus the Cato Company from Dallas County. In each of these arguments, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present argument. Petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these arguments, and Justice Enoch will be recused in the second matter. The court is now ready to hear from petitioners in First National Bank versus Texas Sun Beechcraft.
May it please the court, representing petitioner will be Mr. Tom Davis. He has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. Petitioners in this case are entitled to all reasonable inferences. All conflicts in the evidence must be disregarded, and our evidence must be accepted as true. Respondents have acknowledged this rule, but in their brief, they have neglected to follow it. It was their burden, as movement for summary judgment, to establish as a matter of law that plaintiffs have no cause of action. We've alleged three. They must disprove as a matter of law the elements essential to our cause of action. Our first one is negligence. The facts that we have established are that this aircraft, from the time it was purchased until after Mr. Jack Anderson, the first owner, sold it, had been maintained by Texan.
Counsel, where is it in your brief that you pled negligence? In your petition, excuse me.
It says negligence in it. I was just looking at it, Judge. I think it's on page 96 of the... I can find it right quick.
Does it say negligence per se, or just negligence, general negligence?
It says negligence is a matter of law, which is negligence. Whether it's a matter of law or a matter of fact, it's still negligence. I don't think there's any distinction. And certainly in their motions and in every paper they file, they just refer to it as negligence. They didn't raise as a reason for summary judgment the fact that we didn't say negligence by fact and negligence per se. That was never raised until the Dallas court did. And I submit that that is not a valid distinction. Negligence is negligence. Whether you prove it by proven violation of a regulation or whether you prove it by what they did and let the finders of fact find it. I think we have addressed that in our brief, and I think it's pretty well spelled out in there. I don't see any difference. I don't think there is a difference. I think it's splitting the teeth, and they sure didn't raise it down there below.
Does it really make a difference?
No, sir.
Because the Court of Appeals found that you were barred by collateral estoppel because of the federal lawsuit?
Well, there are other reasons they gave. But we submit that we do have a cause of action by name. Our facts are, as I said, from the day this aircraft was sold by Texan to Jack Anderson until he sold it to Curran, the aircraft had been maintained by Texan. All annuals, annual inspections, and maintenance was done by Texan. Jack Anderson said he was dependent upon Texan to do all the annuals and the maintenance when they were due. It was, quote, part of the deal, quote, close, when Texan sold the aircraft to him. Your federal air regulations have the force and effect of law. And under your federal air regulations, your repair stations must conform to ADs.
Which regulation is that?
43.
No, not which AD, but which regulation?
43.15, I think.
I'll check that for sure. It's in 14 CFR 43.15. which says a print's not too small here. In general, each person performing an inspection shall perform the inspection so as to determine whether the aircraft under inspection meets all the applicable airworthiness requirements. And an AD is an airworthiness requirement. I would, in that connection, while we're on that subject, Your Honor, maybe call your attention to a case, Richards, the FAA administrator, versus Adams. It's an NTSB order number EA-3662. I can call it to the court's attention in the letter after this. But basically, they took away a guy's license because he didn't comply with an AD. And saying that he was required to, it was his duty to do that, and he didn't, and they suspended his license.
So how is it under the regulatory scheme that a business that says they don't have, they're not authorized to do prop repairs can be held accountable for not doing them?
Well, they say they were not required to do that. I think the evidence will show, I think by their own testimony and certainly by an expert that we put in, that they are not permitted to do major repair work. They can do minor repair work. They admitted that whether it's major or minor is a matter of discretion. It's up to the maintenance personnel. That here the AD prescribed the standard. They said anything that has a corrosion pit greater than 0.015, I think it was, you take it out of service and send it back to the factory. If it's less than that, then you repair it. And that drew the distinction between a major and a minor repair. Their own witnesses have admitted to that. So we have in there the affidavit of a qualified inspector out here, Robert Mueller, that says he remembers that AD, he complied with it, and that a repair station is authorized to do minor repairs, and depending upon how deep those corrosion pits were, if they found them, it would be minor or major would determine that.
As a matter of law or federal regulation, when a service station performs an annual inspection on an aircraft, do they, in signing off on the annual inspection, certify that they've done all of the air directives?
Yes, sir, they say, I can almost quote it, that this aircraft on a certain date has been inspected according to Part 43, and we hereby certify that it is airworthy. If it's airworthy, it's got to have complied with every AD, because if it doesn't comply, it's not airworthy and can't be flown. So they do certify that.
What factual disclosures were made regarding the inspection, I presume, under the broad heading of maintenance you're talking about? Inspection and necessary repairs, whether they are minor repairs that are conducted in-house or major repairs that are contracted out to someone else. The overall term maintenance provide for the inspection to detect problems. What are the facts regarding their inspection and determination of this pitting?
All right, sir. Every aircraft, certainly those just general aviation as this one was, must have an annual inspection every 12 months or you can't fly it. You've got to get an annual inspection every 12 months that says it's airworthy. Someone's got to certify that it's airworthy before you can fly it. That's your annual inspection. The testimony we have here and hear from the experts is that on that annual inspection, you must determine whether all outstanding ADs have been complied with. Now, you look in the book to do that. You don't go back and go over every AD, but you get a list of all the ADs that are applicable to that particular aircraft or its components, and then you go through the book and see which ones have been complied with, and those that haven't been complied with, you must comply with, and their own witnesses said if they, it's their duty to do it, their obligation to do it, and if they didn't do it, they were negligent. Does that answer your question?
What are the facts regarding their inspection and detection of this pitting?
The facts were that they were required, obligated, and did maintain and inspect this aircraft for about 2 or 3 or 4 years until Jack Anderson sold it. When he sold it, Mr. Curran testified that he checked in the logbook to see if all the ADs had been complied with. And he was satisfied that all ADs had been complied with, that Texon had complied with them. He was sitting at, so therefore he saw that certification in there. There wasn't but one place that certification could have come from, because up until that point when he bought it, Texon had done all of the maintenance and all of the annual inspections.
The matter surrounding this whole incident, of course, has been litigated in federal court. Why isn't the incident proceeding just a second bite at the apple that's barred under the doctrine of collateral estoppel?
Because all essential elements were not decided in the Philadelphia case, and the requirement of collateral estoppel is all essential elements must have been established in the prior case. They were not. Philadelphia, the jury found it was defective. They found that in our favor, that it was sold with a defect in it. They did not answer causation. And without causation, that is certainly an essential element to recovery under 402A, and that element was not found, and therefore there was lacking an essential element, and collateral estoppel does not apply unless you have all essential elements.
Let me ask you, the case in Philadelphia was being tried on whether or not the product left the manufacturer with a defect.
And was it 402A? Okay. Did they sell a defective product, and was that a cause of this tragic crash?
And you're saying the jury did not answer the causation question?
No,
or
sir.
Or it wasn't submitted to the jury?
It was submitted. They didn't answer it. It's what the court did, is they submitted an issue asking if the warning that was given was adequate.
To cure the defect,
and the court there held that was sufficient. I attack that here. I don't think it's the law. It's ridiculous to think that just sending out an AD is going to correct everything. Didn't correct the one in this airplane, and there's a lot of others.
And that's
what they're saying there, Judge, is here's a matter of fact that they send out hundreds and hundreds of defective propellers. And if they find later down the line that there is a defect, is all they have to do is send out a service bulletin or send out an AAD to those owners that they can find, and that they are then absolved of any liability whatsoever. I say it may minimize their liability, and as the Fifth Circuit said in the case I cited there, it would protect them from punitive damages, but not from compensatory damages. So that is no defense to the sale of a defective product.
But either way, that's a ruling already that's been final.
Yes, sir. That has been found.
Now, the airplane, when it crashed, it had the label on the propeller or it didn't have the label?
It had the decal.
The decal was still on the propeller?
The decal
was gone.
Had been ripped. Was gone.
Okay.
There were some remnants of the decal was on the propeller.
So
little pieces of it, which indicated that someone
had not obeyed the directive.
Had tried to comply with it, but they had not removed all the corrosion pits because that's what caused the failure. I would say that this was evidence of an attempt to comply, but not a proper reply. They didn't get rid of all the corrosion pits.
Because that's what caused the failure. They had to remove it in such a way as to not damage the propeller otherwise. So at the time of this wreck, there was some indication on the propeller that somebody had done something in derogation of the air directive, in that they had scraped or done something on this
They had done no more than the AD directed them to do, which was to remove the decal, look at it, and see if you could find some corrosion pits. And if they weren't deeper than 0.15, then you were to try to smooth them out and get rid of the corrosion pits, put some lacquer on it, and send it back. That's what the AAD required them. And it is evidence that an attempt was made to comply with it, but it was not done properly.
Okay.
Was there evidence that the sealer on the surface of the propeller had been damaged or penetrated in any way, the protective seal?
Well, where
the surface coat that was put on?
Where the decal had been.
Was there gouging or anything into the surface at that point?
Where the decal had been, we had evidence that there were corrosion pits, that at least one or more of those corrosion pits initiated the fatigue fracture that caused the failure. So to what extent, I imagine the lacquer, if it had been removed before you got to the corrosion pit.
Well, that was my question. Basically, in the effort to remove the decal, had someone indeed scraped the surface of the sealer on that propeller blade, the lacquered surface that was beneath the decal, or in effort to get the decal off, had they scraped and penetrated that lacquer?
To get the decal off, you would have to go back to the lacquer. My memory is the lacquer was on top of the decal. To get to the decal, you'd have to remove the lacquer, then the decal, and then you look at the propeller with a magnifying glass. If you find corrosion pits, you remove them, and then lacquer it again and send it back to surface. On our collateral estoppel, I think we were talking about that. I submit that certainly what authority I've been able to find, which is very little, says that that is not a defense, that you cannot make yourself immune to liability for the sale of defective product just by telling somebody they are defective and warning. It will diminish, it will modify, and as the Fifth Circuit said, it will avoid punitive damages, but not compensatory damages. We have another case from Maryland, I believe it, no, Kentucky, I believe it was, and I found one from Nevada, and I can tell you, I searched everywhere I know, and those are only three I found, and they all hold that same thing. There's certainly no authority saying that you can get immune for selling an effective product by warning after the sale. Let me see.
Okay. Counsel, your time has expired unless there are any more questions.
Well, I've saved some for a lot. I want to answer all the questions I can.
Well, I don't believe there are any more, and we do have some time left for rebuttal.
Okay, thank
you. Court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, respondents are represented by Mr. Richard Gately, Mr. Daniel Foster. Mr. Foster will speak first for 6 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dan Foster, and I'm here with Richard Gately today representing Texon and the other respondents. I'll refer to them as Texon. I'll be addressing the products liability collateral estoppel issues, and Mr. Gately will address the negligence issues. Preliminarily, though, I wanted to hit a couple of points on the appellate record. We have raised the fact that requests for admissions that were part of the record in the district court have not been brought forward in the appellate record. On page 430 of the transcript, those are docketed 10-890 and 10-990, the first and second requests for admissions. They were also referenced in our second motion for summary judgment as part of the evidence that we were relying upon. The fact that the appellant failed to bring that forward, they should be presumed to support the judgment of both the Court of Appeals and the trial court.
He said he checked with the clerk and the clerk didn't find it.
The transcript at 4:30 indicates that those were in fact filed, both the first and second requests, and the dates that they were filed. Our recollection is they were filed. We have the copies, the green cards, everything indicating that they were. Additionally, that was mentioned in the motion for summary judgment, the second motion for summary judgment. If there had been a question as to whether or not they were in the record, it seems that it should have been brought forward at that time. Transcript 430. Would also point out to the court that part of what the petitioner is relying upon are documents that were presented to the trial court after summary judgment had already been granted. I'm not sure of the exact page, I believe, beginning with the record at 416, 415. Those are documents that the trial court didn't have. You can't wait until the hearing on the motion for summary judgment, see what the court rules, and then decide later to supplement the record, hoping that you can win on a second motion. This court should determine, as the Court of Appeals did, what the basis or what the record was at the time the trial court considered the motion for summary judgment. The controverting evidence was not before the court at that time. Finally, I believe that counsel has also attempted to object to some of the summary judgment evidence, the Mitchell affidavit. Those objections were not raised at the trial court at the time of the hearing. They've been waived. Turning to the products liability and the estoppel issue, they have tried this case once. Counsel makes a point that we're trying to deprive them of a jury trial. That's false. This case, with the exception of the claim against Texon as opposed to the manufacturers, this case has been tried. Everything, the issues, the evidence, the pleadings, the briefing, all of the both of these cases are exactly the same.
Except for the fact that causation has been ruled on by a fact finder.
But the causation issue did not have to be addressed because the jury, in viewing the two issues that the jury reached, there was no defect. The warnings had cured the defect. Well, there was a defect at the time of the sale that was cured by subsequent warnings that the jury found were sufficient to remove the defect. Taken together, it indicates either that there's no defect or perhaps that goes to the causation issue. But the court rendered a judgment, and the trial in Pennsylvania was strictly on the products liability 402A. There were no other issues. Those were the only claims raised by plaintiffs. And the court rendered a take-nothing judgment from which they didn't appeal. They left it that way. If they had objections as to the way the issues were submitted, they could have raised them at that point with that court in the Court of Appeals.
Was the causation issue conditioned on answers concerning the other issues?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue was conditioned. Once they reached the second issue that the warnings were effective to remove the defect, there was no longer any point to get to the causation.
That wouldn't in and of itself preclude litigation of a negligence issue, would it?
No, sir. No. This is strictly the product's liability of 402A.
So you can sue the manufacturer under 402A and lose, and then subsequently sue the retailer for negligence, and there's no collateral estoppel or res judicata problem?
There would have been potentially a res judicata problem. I don't think there's a collateral estoppel problem. And the issue, the causes would be separate, would be different. The 402A is strictly whether the product was defective or not. The negligence claim in this case is whether or not we did not comply with the AD in the proper manner. So it's a separate cause of action and really separate factual issues. They had no negligence claim against the manufacturer.
There was no trial of the design defect issue in Pennsylvania, was it?
I believe that was submitted in Pennsylvania.
Submitted as a separate issue on design defect as distinguished from failure to warn or adequacy of warning?
I'm not sure that there was a differentiation. There wasn't in the issue, and I cannot recall at this point from the pleadings. I believe the pleadings are exactly the same as what he's pled in this case.
Well, whatever the record might be, just assuming theoretically that it was tried strictly as a marketing case or a failure to warn case, would under principles of collateral estoppel a subsequent design defect case be barred any more than a subsequent negligence case, which you said would not be barred?
If they were submitted, if the factual, the underlying facts, if there was a separate design claim versus warning claim, and only one of those was submitted in Pennsylvania, no, I do not think that would stop the second case.
So you think you could file subsequent lawsuits, or a plaintiff could, one, alleging a product defect, a manufacturing defect against the manufacturer, lose that case, file a subsequent lawsuit alleging a warning defect against the retailer, and then maybe a third lawsuit, a negligence lawsuit against some other body in the chain of commerce, and you could pursue each of those cases independently because you are pursuing a different narrow cause of action against each one?
I think that's definitely potential. The negligence in the products case don't bother me because those are separate facts, assuming you can plead them. I really haven't considered whether res judicata would prevent both of the products cases. My feeling is it would not. It only addresses those issues that were reached in the first lawsuit. And if it wasn't reached, then it would not have the preclusive effect.
Any other questions? Your light has gone off. Sorry. Take more time you may, but it's from your co-counsel.
I think if I could just address a couple of points, and then I'll turn it over to co-counsel. Petitioner mentioned three cases. The Kritzer case, I believe, is Fifth Circuit case that he's primarily relying upon on whether or not a warning will cure a defect or the effect of that warning on the lawsuit.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm maybe a little bit lost. Does Texan say that, I mean, what is the basis of Texan says it's not liable as a matter of law? Why do they say they are not liable under any theory as a matter of law? Or, I mean,
addressing the estoppel issue,
they're saying the only thing you said is I had some sort of imposed duty to remove this label, I suppose, and as a matter of law, I didn't breach that duty or something. Tell me why Texan says, under the pleadings in this case, they are not liable as a matter of law.
Okay, focusing first on the race the collateral estoppel products liability case. The products liability case.
Okay, you said that was strictly a products liability case up in Philadelphia. We're here on the negligence case here. Why?
Okay, well then, addressing the negligence case, the allegations as to negligence are that we did not perform the AD correctly, or right. We failed to perform it. Separate from the products case.
Why do you say that you, as a matter of law, that is not negligence?
Initially, the summary judgment evidence establishes that at the time that we had a possible inspection performed on the aircraft, that we may have done it, the AD in effect at that time did not apply to beach decals on sixth-inch propellers. The AD was amended, effective May of 67, I believe. We last possibly inspected this in March of 67. The amendment added beach decals to the AD, so that instead of just removing sixth-inch decals, that's not what was on this propeller. It's undisputed that at some point a beach decal was on this propeller. Instead of removing sixth-inch, it also extended it to apply to beach decals as of May of 67. That's first and foremost.
So the undisputed evidence that you didn't work on the plane after the time that AD applied to beach craft decals?
That's correct.
Okay. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Your Honor, Richard Gately, co-counsel. To get back to the question of negligence per se, that is the only theory pled in the complaint. And it's Hornbook law that the specific facts alleged in the complaint, or in this case the Second Amendment petition, will control over any general allegations. But if you look at the Second Amendment petition, and the Court of Appeals is correct in its finding, the only thing the Second Amendment petition did was plead negligence per se. Texan contends that it is not negligence per se because the FARs are strictly construed, and the Federal Air Regulations, number one, require owners to comply with airworthiness directives. That's FAR 91-163, and that has been interpreted by the courts in the manner I just stated. The appellants here say that the LaBelle v. McCauley case makes this different. The trouble is, in their brief, they stop short of the full quote in McCauley. At page 48 of that case, the court specifically stated that aircraft owners, that's the only people they mention, must comply with all applicable airworthiness directives. The summary judgment evidence shows that Mr. Jack Anderson, the first owner of this aircraft back in 1966, only allowed TechSun to perform maintenance on the aircraft with his permission. The summary judgment evidence shows that Jack Anderson never requested TechSun to comply with a service bulletin or airworthiness directive on the propeller. Indeed, if you look at the service bulletin from Cincinnati, and I have it in the packet in front of you, and I've highlighted for you the differences, the service bulletin is directed to propeller repair stations because, as one of you mentioned, propeller repair stations are licensed by the federal government to do propeller repairs. The summary judgment evidence before the court is that TechSun did not do propeller repairs. It was not licensed to do so by regulation, which has, as appellants point out, the force of law. The summary judgment evidence shows that on this particular airworthiness directive, because it mentioned corrosion, the only thing that TechSun could do, had the airplane been presented for compliance with the AD, and there is no evidence that there was, the evidence is just to the contrary, the only thing you could have done is taken the propeller off the aircraft and sent it to a FAA-approved propeller repair station with the owner's permission. The one who gets in trouble if repairs are not properly performed is the owner, not the maintenance shop. That's why 91-163 exists. Also, on your packets, if you would like to take the time to compare bulletin R-12A, you will see that R-12A added specific language which said that this R-12A, which was incorporated in the AD as of May 1967, 2 months after TechSun might have done an inspection in March, it says that this includes beach decals, right there, beach decals. If you look at Service Bulletin R-12, which again was not sent to TechSun except through beach, you will see that it mentions nothing about beach decals. It does, as appellants say, it applies to the propeller and the aircraft, but not to the decals. And all construction of the ADs have to be strictly construed. And it's a matter of law for the court to decide.
Well, the trial was not sent to them except for a beach. As a Beechcraft dealer, they did get this bulletin.
Yes, sir. But the undisputed summary judgment proof shows that R-12A was not sent to TechSun until after the March 67 inspection.
And how many annual inspections did TechSun do of this point?
We only know of one, and if you resolve inferences in favor of the plaintiff, possibly two in 1967. There was one in 66 and one in 1967.
Did the logbook go down with the plane?
No, sir. The logbook did not go down with the plane. It is missing and has never been found.
When TechSun did the annual inspection in those 1 or 2 years, by signing off on that annual inspection with the language that I was asking Mr. Davis about, was not TechSun certifying that the plane was airworthy and therefore met all applicable ADs?
It did. The undisputed summary judgment evidence from that cited by Mr. Davis, even outside the motion of rehearing, is that TechSun was not assuming responsibility for the work of the propeller shop. But we say that the negligence per se is the only theory alleged, and there is no negligence per se because there was no AD outstanding as of March 1967, which TechSun could have complied with. The outstanding AD was on the propeller with Cincinnati decals, and you will see, look at the R-12, and it's the only decals that are pictured. And if you look at the AD itself, you will see that it refers, in your packet of information, I've highlighted this, it says for a description of the decals to which it applies, see Cincinnati Service Bulletin R-12, which only talks about Cincinnati's decal. Then it was amended in 1967, and it says, look at R-12A. And in the packets of information that I gave you, you will see that Beechcraft duly sent the service bulletins to its distributor, and it's undisputed that Texsun would have gotten that service bulletin. Mr. Mitchell, the sole surviving employee of Texsun, tells us they would have. But he says they would not have gotten the Beechcraft directive to owners until 1967, in April. The Beechcraft service bulletin itself, or notification, says beach decals have been added, and that's in the packet of materials that I sent you. So basically stated, there are specific allegations of negligence per se, and we say that Texsun is not liable on a negligence per se cause of action, the only one pled, because number one, there is no AD to which was in force and effect in March of 1967, and because the owner under 91-163 is responsible, and there's no dispute that Texsun was neither an owner, nor was it an operator, nor was it a manufacturer. As far as collateral estoppel, I agree that collateral estoppel has precluded any issue of design defect, and as the Court of Appeals properly found on reviewing the stipulations in the Pennsylvania case, the plaintiff was claiming a design defect in that propeller. However those issues were submitted, or whether Texas would agree with the way they submitted, is irrelevant. He had his day in court. The jury charge was conditional. If that was improper, that's something to be raised with the Pennsylvania court. It's not something that this court should have to sit and say, well, how would we submit it? And the Chrysler case, by its own language, upholds that position. The other point is there are 109 admissions at the trial court, as shown by the docket entry. And those admissions have not been brought forward.
Let's, on the negligence issue, let's say that they argue, at least arguably, that the duty arises from the bulletin. You now said, well, we didn't get the bulletin until after we looked at the airplane under the facts favorable to the plaintiff, so, I mean, we're not even in this picture. But somebody scraped the label off of the propeller. Why couldn't there be, under the state of the pleadings, arguably a cause of action for negligent removal of this label that itself was what caused the corrosion to the propeller? How do you, I mean, if it's read that way, how do you escape as a matter of law a claim of general negligence?
Because the summary judgment proof, there's no summary judgment proof even by their expert. The best he can do is what you said. Somebody took it off. No one ever accuses Texsun of removing the decal. And the affidavit of Mr. Mitchell says that Texsun would not have removed this decal because it was a major propeller repair. That was the state of the evidence at the summary judgment trial court level. After that, they came in with a motion for rehearing, and they looked at Mr. Mitchell's deposition. They found something they thought was favorable, which I think read in context is not. But they went to their own fellow out here at Mueller Airport and got him to, you know, create this fact issue. But that's too late. It's too little too late. So I think that the duties that we have to look at is the state of the record and what was available to Texsun at the time. If they were not an owner and operator, as a matter of law, they do not have the duty to comply with an AD. And Mr. Mitchell's affidavit clearly points out that if an owner said, well, I don't want you to comply with the AD, the only thing Texsun could do was call the FAA inspector over there and say this owner is not complying with the AD. Texsun legally could not return the aircraft to service. It didn't have to sign off on the logbook, but it didn't have a duty to fix the aircraft for the owner. The owner is the sole one responsible for that configuration.
And if you question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I would simply pray that the Court of Appeals' decision be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
I'll try to hit as many of these points as I can. Any reference to Mr. Mitchell's testimony flies right square in the face of the law on summary judgment. They're trying to take evidence that's favorable to them and presenting it here as summary judgment evidence. Mitchell did not say what they said.
he admitted that less than 1.5 would be mine and all that. The point I'm going to make is a lot of this so-called evidence was just what I said, they were violating the rule. They're talking about evidence they have that favors them, but avoids evidence that favors us. Owner responsibility. There's testimony from nearly every qualified man who we got in there that the only thing, the owner cannot perform maintenance. The regulations won't let him. I can change oil in my airplane, and that's about all. I have to go to someone and turn it over to them that's qualified and certified and depend upon them that they're going to do it and they're going to do it right. That's as far as any owner can go.
How do you respond to Mr. Foster's comment that the only evidence that places Texan in control of this airplane for repair shows that it was completed before the bulletin involved Beach aircraft labels?
I'm not sure that I quite understand, but let me point out something here a minute, Judge. Yeah, here we go. I do not believe there's any evidence in this record that this AD 66-23-2 did not apply to this aircraft from the time it was issued.
I think his argument was it applied to the aircraft, applied to the propellers, but it only applied to a particular type of label that was affixed to the propeller and not to Beechcraft labels.
The AD says, Your Honor, that this applies to all fixed-pitch metal propeller models with water-soluble deep mid-blade decals. Our propeller was a fixed-pitch metal propeller model with water-soluble mid-blade decals. That's what the AD says, and they're saying it doesn't apply. I don't understand it. Certainly no one testified to that.
There was the related contention, as I understood it, that at the time that they did their last annual inspection, there was no outstanding AD that they needed to comply with.
This AD was effective October 1st, 1966. The last time they admit they could have done that they could have done an annual inspection was in March of 67, after this AD was issued. And if it doesn't apply to this, it describes it perfectly.
So it's irrelevant whether it mentioned the Beechcraft decal by name, so long as that was the kind of decal that was addressed by the AD.
Yeah. In fact, they're talking about service bulletins. This is the AD that the FAA came out with. They're talking about some minute difference in their service bulletin 12 and 12A. It wasn't 12 and 12A that put the responsibility on them. It was this AD that put the responsibility on them. But if you look at 12 and 12A, you'll find there's very little difference, if any, that they refer. They're in the record. You can look at them, but you can look at them. And there's very little difference, if any, but that's not the issue. The issue is the AD. And we just read what it says to apply to and see if that's not ours. When they sign off, a question you said, any time they did an annual and they signed it off, they had to be sure that every AD pertinent had been complied with. Whether they did it or someone else had done it, when they signed it off, they're certifying that they had been done, and that's their own testimony. They're certified that all ADs had been complied with, and we know this went through some...
If the AD came out in October, they did an inspection in May, the decal should have been removed in March or May or whatever.
Yes, sir.
The subsequent date they had an opportunity to inspect.
Yes, sir.
And repair.
Yes, sir. The aircraft should not have been certified as airworthy unless they had complied with it. You asked about the submission of the issue of a warning if it was submitted conditionally. It was, but over our objection.
If there was error in the submission of that issue, that error was not challenged on appeal, isn't that, don't you have some obligation to pursue all the appellate remedies for the erroneous submission in the federal district court through the federal appellate system?
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that this court is under no obligation to follow things that aren't the law. no matter what court said they were. I don't think that's the law of Texas.
Well, with regards to collateral estoppel, are we barred from going beyond what the Federal District Court did and let what they said stand on it? Can you fail the challenge?
They're asking you to hold collateral estoppel. We say, even though we didn't get an essential issue, they say you got an essential issue, the warning. I say that's not the law. That's not the law in Texas. And this court would be holding that was the law. If you held that was an essential element, you'd be holding that that is the law. And I submit to you it is not the law. It doesn't make sense. And not only that, every authority we can find says that just the warning doesn't just immunize you from any liability at all. And you would have to be adopting that as the law of Texas in order to say that we are not lacking an essential element. This request for admissions, I don't know what they're talking about. I can find in my files no request for admissions. I've checked with the clerk. I can't find them. Look in their pleadings and for summary judgment, and they recite things that they're relying on and mark it as an exhibit, and they get down to Exhibit E, and after Exhibit E, after they've named specifically the thing they're required to, they say, and admissions on file, little a, on the admissions, little a. In their brief, they're putting a capital A. If there were any requests for admissions, I don't know where they were. They certainly haven't told us what was in them that's so destroying of our case. And if they can't find them, then I don't know where they are. I would like to point out to one typographical error in our brief. We refer at one, I'll give you the page in just a second, Johnny. We refer to a minor point on page 10. We refer to AD 66-23-1. That should be dash 2. That's a typo. This was not a case of failure to warn or a case of failure for design. I'll admit that the sending out of notice after you discover the defect would be some evidence to use in a case for failure to warn. It would be admissible then as to whether you failed to warn when you did that. We deliberately did not bring that as an issue because we didn't think it was, and it wasn't a design defect case. This was a case because when this propeller left the cellar, it had this water-soluble decal in it with some contaminated water that over the years had caused corrosion pits to form, which caused this propeller to fail.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Right. The court will now take a brief recess.
Judge, please rise.